An advanced staff member grabbed me to ride with President Obama in his SUV. My guess is the staffer hoped I would know what to say during the long ride as President Obama prepared for what we all knew would be an excruciating afternoon. I had no idea what to say, so I said nothing. In the car, President Obama read over his prepared remarks. When he finished, I don't know if he was talking to me or to himself, but he put them aside and said, "This won't work." Then, as I'd seen him do many times before, he pulled out a yellow pad and a pen out of his briefcase and began to write. I wondered how he could possibly craft a message that would console the families before their loved ones who had died had even been buried. I considered reaching out and touching his arm to give him some comfort since words had failed me, but I didn't want to distract him. In fact, I was staying so quiet that I even became acutely conscious of my breathing. We rode in silence with the gentle roar of the limo's engine and the two Secret Service agents in the front, also staring straight ahead in silence. The president used the entire ride to compose his remarks, and as we exited the SUV, he gave the yellow pad to one of his staff members and said, "Please have this typed up." The advance team had assembled the families of the victims in multiple rooms in a building in downtown Newtown. As we approached the first room, I was relieved to see Joshua Dubois, who had traveled to Newtown early with the advance team. Although Joshua was only in his early 30s, he was an old soul with plenty of experience in grief counseling. But the concerned expression on his young face caught me off guard. He pulled me close and whispered that the families were in awful shape. I'd expected as much, of course, but Joshua's caution told me I wasn't at all prepared for what we were about to encounter. I took a deep breath as we entered the first room. Inside, there were four or five family groups, each sitting clustered together in circles, several family members crying and others trying to comfort them. Each cluster was accompanied by a first responder who I learned had remained with his or her assigned family since the day of the shooting. President Obama went around the room, talking with each family member individually, listening to their grief and offering quiet words of condolence. Several showed him photos of their deceased loved ones. One photo, which I can still close my eyes and see vividly, was a large close-up of the faces of a young boy and girl, twins. The image had been handed to the president by the surviving twin, a little girl named Ariel, whose brother Noah had been murdered that day. As we moved from family to family, and then from room to room, I walked behind President Obama and visited with each family after the president had moved to the next. Some people, who'd held their composure when speaking with the president, collapsed as I approached. Still, at a loss for words, I mostly just hugged them, knowing that nothing I said would be remembered or help with their pain. After an agonizing 2 hours with the families, President Obama visited with the state troopers and other first responders, many of whom had witnessed the horrific crime scene firsthand. He understood they, too, had experienced profound trauma and deserved words of comfort and appreciation for their service. President Obama took just a few minutes to read over his typed remarks, not wanting to keep the families waiting, and then we moved into the auditorium where everyone was already seated for the service. I slipped into an open seat in the front row next to a man sitting alone, thinking nobody should sit alone at a time like this. The room was perfectly quiet. Governor Malloy spoke, and then President Obama began. "I can only hope it helps for you to know that you're not alone in your grief, that our world, too, has been torn apart, that all across this land of ours, we have wept with you. We've pulled our children tight, reminding everyone that there is no charge more important than protecting our children from harm." He told stories of the courage and heroism of the surviving children, staff, and first responders. He also shared an emotion that he often used when talking about Malia and Sasha. Someone once described the joy and anxiety of parenthood as the equivalent of having your heart outside of your body all of the time. The president mentioned each person who had been murdered by name, each one cutting through the air like a sharp knife, bringing home the reality of what had happened. The man next to me could barely catch his breath. He was crying so hard. I didn't know what to do. Impulsively, I reached out to hold his hand, but unsure of whether such closeness with a stranger would help, I pulled back after only touching him lightly. He didn't notice, consumed by his own grief. How President Obama found those perfect words during the car ride, I will never know. I do know that when he finished, I saw one of his Secret Service agents brushing a tear from her face. I'd never seen that before or since. Sandy Hook was the president's fourth appearance at a memorial after a mass shooting. They never became any easier, and with each one, we felt increasingly frustrated by our own inability to prevent them. We mourned the victims and consoled their families, but felt there must be more we could and should do to stop the epidemic of gun violence. Soon after the memorial in Connecticut, the president made a push to persuade Congress to pass legislation closing background check loopholes. Are we really prepared to say that we're powerless in the face of such carnage, that the politics are too hard, he asked? Are we prepared to say that such violence visited on our children year after year after year is somehow the price of our freedom? As they always did after every mass shooting, Republicans and the National Rifle Association exclaimed, "It's too soon," and accused us of politicizing the tragedy. And even though polls demonstrated that 90% of the American people supported such legislation, Congress refused to act. The day we realized that we didn't have enough votes to get such simple, obvious legislation passed was one of my most depressing moments. For me, the issue was personal. My father's father died from gun violence when I was only 15 years old. An avid hunter, he owned rifles and handguns, including one he kept in his D.C. dental office, knowing he could be a target because of the opiates he kept stocked there. On the very last day before he retired, he was closing up shop when two young men broke into his office and pulled a gun on him. Instead of handing over the drugs they wanted, my grandfather pulled out his own gun, which they wrestled away from him and then used to murder him. And here's the devastating twist. The men who'd broken in to rob him had only a toy gun. So to all those who say having a gun makes you safer, well, it didn't help my grandfather. There is a reason our military and police go through rigorous, ongoing training on how to use guns. It isn't human nature or normal to take another life. As President Obama prepared to give a speech announcing the Republicans' latest defeat of reasonable gun control legislation, a member of my staff came into my office and let me know that a few of the Sandy Hook parents we'd invited to the announcement were gathered in the Roosevelt Room. I knew that I needed to go downstairs and talk with them while they waited for the president. I walked slowly from my office down one flight of stairs to the first floor and through the West Wing lobby to the Roosevelt Room, trying to rehearse what I could possibly say in the face of this defeat. They had lobbied legislators so hard, reliving their personal tragedy over and over, and still we couldn't get anything through Congress. Once again, there was nothing I could say that would be comforting. Instead, all I could say was, "Please don't give up." One of the moms who'd lost her 6-year-old son in the shooting said, "I have no choice. I can't give up." And they didn't. Several of the Sandy Hook parents founded Sandy Hook Promise, a grassroots organization advocating for ways to protect children against gun violence. I kept in close contact with two of the parents, Nicole Hockley and Mark Barden, through the rest of the second term as we continued to work on executive orders to address this epidemic. When Congress failed to act, executive orders were our only option, and we joined forces with advocates, researchers, and state and local elected officials across the country to push for safer gun laws. The first round of 23 executive actions were signed by President Obama on January 16, 2013. On January 29th, Hadiya Pendleton, a 15-year-old girl who had marched in the inauguration parade 8 days earlier, was shot while hanging out with a group of friends in a park in North Kenwood, the community we had worked so hard to improve, less than a mile from my home in Chicago. I attended her funeral with Michelle Obama. Before it began, Michelle met with Hadiya's devastated classmates, including Hadiya's best friend, who had been sitting right next to her when the gunshot was fired. The First Lady told them to honor Hadiya by living out the best life Hadiya certainly would have had. President Obama's final announcement of executive orders to keep guns out of the wrong hands was made in January of his last year in office. By that point, any hope of working with Congress had completely faded. The president was introduced at the event in the East Room by Mark Barton, still raw and grieving from the loss of his son Daniel. Listening to Mark's remarks off camera in the green room no doubt touched President Obama deeply, because in a rare display of emotion, he cried openly soon after he began to speak. I was sitting in the front row next to Gabby Giffords, who thankfully held my hand for the entire 20-minute program. My last week in the White House, Nicole and Mark came by my office to say goodbye. Seeing them one last time there was emotional for us all. We developed a friendship out of tragedy, but what we left unspoken that day was our lack of progress in Congress. For 8 years, we'd watched Republicans put their short-term political agenda ahead of what the majority of Americans wanted. As I sat with Nicole and Mark on my couch, they talked about how the pain of losing a child doesn't get any easier. For this grief, time does not heal. My emotions were many. There was sorrow. There was impotence. How was it that we are the only developed country in the world with anywhere near this level of gun violence? How could we call ourselves the most powerful nation on earth when we couldn't even keep our citizens safe within our own borders? But what I felt, more than any other emotion, was anger towards the Republicans in Congress and the NRA, probably the most vile example I know of where the will of a special interest subverts the good of society. While masking itself as a pro-gun rights group, the NRA in reality is a lobbying organization for gun manufacturers. Its strategy, which relies on raising fears that the government is trying to take away all guns, is really about increasing gun sales. The playbook is always the same. After every mass shooting, the NRA bullies anyone who calls for the most sensible and obvious measures to keep guns out of the hands of people who are a threat to others or to themselves. It shames anyone who speaks up. It calls for wider use of guns, for arming teachers. The state and federal elected officials in its pocket offer prayers instead of legislative solutions after each mass shooting. How we buy and sell guns in this country is necessarily a matter of public policy. And when it's easier to get an AR-15 or a handgun than it is to register to vote, then it's a failure of public policy and political will. When domestic abusers, criminals, and even people on terrorist watch lists can easily avoid background checks and buy guns, that's exactly the kind of crisis our political system is supposed to solve. Special interests beyond the gun lobby are by nature invested in preserving the status quo or rolling back adverse legislation or regulation. And to take them on, you have to appreciate how fiercely those who stand to benefit will fight to keep the status quo. The coal industry, which didn't want us to control pollution, claimed we were anti-business when we were imposing clean air regulations. They wanted to be left alone, even if it meant creating an unhealthy climate. The banking industry's top institutions, which took risks that required a taxpayer bailout, spent millions of dollars in lobbying to resist Dodd-Frank because they didn't want the federal government to limit their ability to take risks. But look what happens when any industry sets its own parameters. The lesson here isn't just that industry without regulation will run amok, but also that the only force that can counter this truth is the will of the American people. Just as I'd reached out to Governor Malloy of Connecticut after Sandy Hook, in the 9 days since the shooting at Emmanuel AME, I'd been in close contact with Charleston's Mayor Joe Riley, one of the nation's longest-serving and most respected mayors, about the burial plans. Since President Obama knew Reverend Pinckney, he'd asked me to call the Reverend's widow and let her know he would be willing to speak at the service if she would like him to do so. Mayor Riley connected us, and she graciously accepted. A few days later, I was flying with President Obama on Marine One when he asked his staff to compile data on the number of Americans killed by foreign terrorists on our soil compared with the number of Americans killed by gun violence. He wanted to demonstrate to the public where the real epidemic lay. Just as the president was making this point to us, Eric Schultz, the deputy White House press secretary, read us a news report. Family members of those murdered at Mother Emanuel were overheard at the assassin's arraignment saying that they had forgiven him. How could they forgive so quickly after such a devastatingly random act of violent hatred? President Obama slowly shook his head, and we were all stunned that they could find their forgiveness in their hearts so soon after their loss. "Such grace," he said. Having given far too many eulogies already, the president was searching for fresh words to console and to motivate America to take action. That's why he tried to carve out some extra time alone that morning upstairs. But once the Obergefell decision came down, that plan went out the window. The next hour was chaos. The president had to finalize a difficult eulogy while simultaneously writing a speech about a landmark decision guaranteeing that love means love. I had my own work to do as well. Equality for the LGBTQ community was a victory for all historically marginalized groups, from women to Black people to Latinos to those with disabilities. The broader progressive movement understood that we were all linked together. So not only was I responsible for outreach to the LGBTQ advocacy groups and the legal scholars we'd encouraged to write amicus briefs in support of marriage equality, but I also had to quarterback outreach to a whole range of civil rights groups. I also had to track down James Obergefell, the plaintiff in the case, so that President Obama could congratulate him personally. After my team found him in the middle of his own press conference, Obergefell placed the president's call on speakerphone so that everyone could hear what the president had to say. Meanwhile, the staff at the White House was furiously assembling the stage in the Rose Garden, where President Obama would deliver his remarks on the Supreme Court ruling before departing on time for Charleston. Even early in his career, when punctuality was not his strong suit, President Obama was never late to a funeral, for he thought it would be disrespectful to those who were grieving. For Rose Garden speeches, there was an unwritten rule that staffers, even senior staffers, should all be too busy to hang out and gawk, so anyone not directly involved in the topic of the speech usually watches in the seclusion of their own offices. But on that day, the iconic colonnade that runs along the north border of the Rose Garden, connecting the West Wing to the residence, was packed to the brim with staff from all departments crying tears of joy and hugging one another. Everyone wanted to be present for the historic announcement. The energy in the crowd grew still when the press aide announced the two-minute warning before President Obama emerged from the Oval Office, just west of the Rose Garden, walked out to his podium, and, despite the time crunch and competing emotions of the day, took the time to reflect on the larger context of how all historic change happens in our democracy. "Progress on this journey often comes in small increments," he said, sometimes 2 steps forward, 1 step back, propelled by the persistent effort of dedicated citizens. And then, sometimes there are days like this, when that slow, steady effort is rewarded with justice that arrives like a thunderbolt. In his remarks, President Obama echoed the idea originally attributed to the 19th century abolitionist Theodore Parker, but refined in a quote made famous by Martin Luther King Jr., that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. That quote was so meaningful to the president that he had it, together with his other favorite historic quotes, woven into the border of his rug, specially designed for the Oval Office. As soon as the president finished his remarks, he and I walked straight from the Rose Garden to Marine One, where we were joined by Mrs. Obama for the quick hop out to Andrews Air Force Base and then the 90-minute flight down to Charleston. A sense of dread slowly crept into our euphoria over the marriage equality case as we talked about the day that lay ahead. To ease the mood, President Obama casually mentioned, with a twinkle in his eye, that he wanted to give us a heads up that he might sing in his eulogy. He would see how he felt in the moment. I learned my lesson a few years back when I told him not to sing Let's Stay Together by Al Green at a fundraiser in New York. As we waited backstage for the famous soul singer to finish, President Obama joked with his stage engineers that he might sing too. I strongly discouraged him, but he did it anyway. The video of him singing went viral. It was a huge hit. Clearly, bad advice on my part. This time, I simply said great. More out of curiosity than in disapproval, Michelle asked where exactly he envisioned an appropriate moment in the eulogy for singing. He replied that the eulogy was going to be about grace, amazing grace. She shrugged and said, "You be you." The Emmanuel AME shooting wasn't just the latest depraved incident in a crescendo of mass shootings and gun violence. It had also come in the midst of what seemed like a constant barrage of violent murders of unarmed, peaceful, and law-abiding Black Americans, often at the hands of police. As a candidate, Barack Obama's remarks on the issue of race had galvanized and united people. But as president, starting with the Skip Gates incident in 2009, each time he spoke about race, it often seemed to inflame and agitate. So he had learned to choose his words carefully, as he had on the 50th anniversary of both the March on Washington on the Mall in front of the Lincoln Memorial and the Voting Rights Act, where we recreated a peaceful walk across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. The violence endured by Black people has been an ever-present issue for America, but it returned to the forefront of the nation's consciousness during the Obama administration with the killing of Trayvon Martin, a Black 17-year-old who was attacked, shot, and killed for nothing more than walking down the street, eating Skittles in a gated Florida neighborhood, his own neighborhood. In the wake of the killing of Trayvon Martin, I was in the Oval Office with David Plouffe, then a senior advisor, who was prepping the president for a planned announcement about a different subject. President Obama paced in front of his desk, visibly upset about Martin's death. David tried to turn the subject to the purpose of the press conference, but in an uncharacteristically loud, emotional voice, President Obama said to David, "You know, if I had a son, he would look like Trayvon." After a rather awkward silence, he added, "I want to speak about this at the press conference. Ask one of the reporters to ask me a question about it." And so there, in the Rose Garden, in front of the press, a slightly calmer President Obama repeated what he had said earlier. "If I had a son, he would look like Trayvon." 18 months later, Martin's killer was acquitted on spurious claims of self-defense. I wasn't surprised by the verdict. Talking to one of my white colleagues who was shocked by the jury's decision, I explained that most Black people, including me, have low expectations of justice from the criminal justice system. President Obama summed up this sentiment in an impromptu press conference after the 2013 not guilty verdict was handed down. It's important to recognize that the African American community is looking at this issue through a set of experiences and history that doesn't go away, he said, choosing his words as carefully as ever. How do we learn some lessons from this and move in a positive direction, President Obama asked, beyond protests and vigils? He called on the American people to think about how we bolster and reinforce our African-American boys. He gathered his senior team and directed us to develop a plan to break down the barriers that prevent Black boys and young men from getting a fair shot. Not just yet another government program that depends on the political whims of Congress or the president, but rather a sustainable partnership with business and the philanthropic community. A short time later, I accompanied President Obama home to Chicago, where he was scheduled to give remarks at Hyde Park High School. Before the speech, he sat down at a roundtable meeting with about 15 Black male high school students who were all enrolled in Becoming a Man, a program that, according to analysis by the University of Chicago Crime Lab, cut violent crime arrests in half and boosted the high school graduation rates of its participants by nearly 20%. To the surprise of the boys, the president came down off the pedestal the teenagers put him on so that they could understand that the only difference between them was that he had grown up in a more forgiving atmosphere with a far greater margin for error. President Obama even kept in touch with the young men long after the visit. It meant as much to him as it did to them. Later that year, he invited them to the White House around Father's Day, and they decided to sign a Father's Day card for him. One young man admitted, "I've never signed a Father's Day card before." To which President Obama responded, "Me neither." When we returned to D.C., President Obama used Becoming a Man as the guiding example for a program he hoped to launch nationwide. Because of his strong commitment to mentoring young Black men and boys, Cabinet Secretary Broderick Johnson was chosen by the president to head up the effort that became My Brother's Keeper. Launched in March 2015, My Brother's Keeper began as a public-private partnership between the federal government, local elected officials, not-for-profits such as Emerson Collective, and businesses such as the NBA, designed to intervene with evidence-based strategies that improve the trajectory of the lives of boys and young men of color. After President Obama left office, he housed the program in the Obama Foundation, and it continues to work in over 200 cities and make a huge impact, one young person at a time. Obviously, the president identified with the experiences of young Black men forced to endure both subtle and not-so-subtle racism directed at them, from watching white women clutch their handbags closer to not being able to flag down a cab, to being mistaken for a server or a valet in a restaurant, to being stopped and frisked and harassed, and sometimes shot by police. I had an early lesson on the dangers for Black teenage boys when I was about 12 years old. My mom and I were driving near our home when we saw the police had stopped two of our neighbors, Black teenagers a few years older than me. The police officers had already gotten out of their police car to question them. My mother immediately stopped our car and started to get out. "Where are you going?" I asked her. "I need to go and make sure they'll be okay," she said. I didn't want her to get involved, but she refused my pleas. "No," she said, "I can't leave them here." Although the boys lived about a block away, the police wanted to know what they were doing in such a nice neighborhood. My mother wasn't having any of it. "I can vouch for them," she said to the police. "I know them both. Please let them go." Whether it was because they thought she was white or because she intimidated them just as she does everybody else, the officers let them go. At first, I was just selfishly worried about my mom, but reflecting on the incident as I grew older, I always wondered what would have happened to them if she hadn't shown up. I was proud of my mom for intervening. The moment also left a lasting impression on the way race can trump affluence. More incidents of young, unarmed Black men being killed began to surface. In Ferguson, Missouri, where that long simmering anger erupted into months of protest after Michael Brown, just 2 days shy of starting college, was shot dead by the police, his body left in the streets for hours. There was Eric Garner in New York City, choked to death by police for allegedly selling loose cigarettes on the street. There was Laquan McDonald in Chicago, shot 16 times in the back while walking down the street. There was 12-year-old Tamir Rice in Cleveland, shot while playing with a toy gun in the park, and on and on and on. When the Ferguson demonstration started, the Obamas and I were on vacation together, watching them on TV. Tensions boiled over the night of August 18th, when armed police fired tear gas and rubber bullets at crowds of protesters. There were several reported injuries, and a series of businesses were vandalized and looted. I called Missouri Governor Jay Nixon to see what his perspective was, and he told me he determined it necessary to call in the National Guard. The situation was spiraling out of control. While police in the suburb of St. Louis established a nightly curfew, President Obama, Attorney General Eric Holder, and I evaluated what we could do to calm this community growing more volatile by the day. Some had called for President Obama to go to Ferguson, thinking his physical presence was a necessary sign of support, but the police had their hands full containing the situation, and the president's presence would strain local law enforcement. Plus, knowing a federal investigation would surely follow, he was careful about putting his foot on the scale. The person with oversight over the investigation, Eric Holder, went instead. The community knew of the Attorney General's lifelong commitment to creating a fair criminal justice system, and his team was on the ground working with local law enforcement to restore the peace. It also helped that he was known to have a very close personal relationship with President Obama. President Obama was determined to turn this inflection point into an opportunity to improve the bond of trust between communities of color and the police. That December, President Obama issued an executive order creating the President's Task Force on 21st Century Policing, an 11-member committee charged with recommending ways police can do their jobs while earning the public's trust. One of the members was Brittany Packnett, an executive director of Teach for America in St. Louis, and also an activist instrumental in organizing the demonstrations in Ferguson and other protests around the country that became the movement known as Black Lives Matter. The president had met Brittany when he invited her and a few other young activists to the Oval Office earlier that month. My team organized the meeting, and I sat with my back to the Resolute desk with the group sitting on the couches closest to his chair. The president and I listened as they told us their stories. What I heard were young people who were both strident and exhausted, in awe of where they were, but still willing to be confrontational. The president knowingly smiled and reminded them of his early days as a community organizer. "I still remember what it's like knocking on doors in the cold," he said. "I know your frustration." Then, after letting them vent, he offered some good advice. "Don't try to solve world peace," he said. "Just try to move the needle a little bit, and then a little bit more." Brittany, who also co-founded Campaign Zero, a policy platform to end police violence, was so impressive that the president ultimately asked me to invite her to join the president's task force on 21st century policing. Unsure if her views would be taken seriously and worried about losing her credibility among her fellow activists, she initially turned down the appointment. I called her a couple of times to persuade her, and my staff called many more. Eventually, Brittany agreed to join us, taking a leap of faith that she'd be able to accomplish more inside the tent than outside. So Brittany found herself working with Lori Robinson, one of the nation's foremost experts on criminal justice policy, and former Philadelphia Police Commissioner Charles Ramsey, as well as other leaders several years her senior, and she took to heart the president's advice to focus on the concrete change you believe will actually make a difference. What the young activist felt most strongly about was that police misconduct should be investigated by special prosecutors, given that prosecutors work so closely with the police. No one else on the task force initially supported her recommendation. but over time, she persuaded every other member, and they unanimously included her recommendation in the task force's final report. When we arrived at the College of Charleston for Reverend Pinckney's memorial, nearly 6,000 mourners filled the arena. The Obamas paid their respects to Mrs. Pinckney and her two darling daughters, dressed in white. I stood off to the side, fighting back tears and dreading the service. But when we walked into the huge venue, the energy was strong. This was not just a time to mourn, but also a celebration of life. "What a good man," President Obama said of the pastor he had met on the campaign trail in 2008. "Sometimes I think that's the best thing to hope for when you're eulogized. After all the words and recitations and resumes are read, to just say someone was a good man." But the president was not finished. For those of us old enough to remember, the Pinckney service triggered painful memories of the four little black girls who died in the Sunday morning bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham in 1963. President Obama schooled all who listened that day on the history of the black church. He spoke of hush harbors and our beating hearts, the place where our dignity as a people is inviolate. Within this narrative, he argued that it was consistent with the tradition of the black church to welcome any stranger, such as a young white man new to an evening Bible study, and for the families of the victims to respond to brutal hatred and violence with amazing grace. It's a delicate task to go beyond the celebration of life at a moment like that, but I could feel the open hearts of the richly diverse congregation. In the front row with President and Mrs. Obama were Governor Nikki Haley, who just days earlier had announced that she supported taking down the Confederate flag, a gutsy position that could have been political suicide in South Carolina, but won her accolades in a national spotlight. Mayor Joseph Riley, sporting his trademark bow tie, just like my dad's, and Hillary Clinton, who had peeled off the presidential campaign trail to attend. Every national and local civil rights leader was there, and the congregation was electric in defiant celebration of the lives that had been lost. Near the end of his remarks, President Obama built to a crescendo. Then he paused, closed his eyes, and yes, began to sing. "Amazing grace, how sweet the sound." For a moment, I wondered how the congregation was going to react. It didn't take more than 5 seconds, though, for everyone to rise and burst into song together. We were one. President Obama's challenge to the congregation that day was not to betray the short life of Reverend Pinckney by slipping into a comfortable silence, but to raise our voices to address poverty, dilapidated schools, hatred of all kinds, and gun violence. After Reverend Pinckney's memorial, we boarded Air Force One for the flight back to Washington, D.C., nearing the end of an unbelievable day, filled with the euphoria of the Supreme Court verdict and the commemoration of a good man's life. Fortunately, I knew a special secret that was in store for that night. A few weeks earlier, Aditi Hardikar, my LGBTQ liaison, had brought me an idea cooked up by Jeff Tiller from our press office. "I know this is probably a crazy idea and it can't be done," she said. "We never have done it before, and I'm not sure anyone will think it's a good idea. But if the Supreme Court rules in favor of marriage equality or rules against it, what if we light the White House in a rainbow to reflect the colors of pride?" "Excellent idea," I said, imagining an iconic photo that would forever symbolize the extraordinary progress made for LGBTQ equality on our watch. "Now let's figure out if we can get it done." The next step was to run the traps, which meant making sure everyone was on board, including the president and first lady. This one was a slam dunk. Everyone loved the idea, so Tina Chen, by then the first lady's chief of staff, figured out how to do it. I sent out a tweet shortly after we returned, opaquely mentioning to pay attention to the White House. At dusk, passerbys began to notice the colors, the entire northern facade of the White House lit up like a rainbow. The crowd grew. They started posting photos on social media. Long after the sun had gone down, after the colors turned from pale to vibrant, thousands of people were still gathered outside of the gates of the White House celebrating, while those of us on the North Lawn, who worked on marriage equality, shared stories of how impossible this victory seemed 6 years earlier. In that moment, celebrating with many of my colleagues with whom I had worked so hard to help make that day possible, I appreciated how lucky we were that the pendulum of progress had swung so far on our watch. When President Obama took office, same-sex marriage was legal in only 2 states. Right before that June date, as a result of grassroots organizing by advocates all across the country, it was legal in 37 states and the District of Columbia. Each victory, I believe, making it easier for the Supreme Court to reach the right conclusion. But, as is always the case for major leaps forward, the groundwork had been laid by decades of hard work. In 2010, for my birthday present, President Obama gave me a copy of 2 documents side by side in a frame. On one side is the Petition for Universal Suffrage, dated January 29, 1866, signed by a group of suffragists, including Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, women who called on Congress to amend the Constitution to grant women the right to vote. Next to it is the joint resolution of Congress proposing a constitutional amendment extending the right of suffrage to women, dated March 19, 1919. The two are over 50 years apart. Many of the women who protested with the hunger strikes and were arrested and jailed in the movement didn't live to see the fruits of their efforts in 1919. But they carried the baton and then they passed it on to others. Change takes time, sacrifice, resilience, and hard work over a sustained period of time. But then, eventually, seeming like a thunderbolt, it happens. The many same-sex couples who'd been forced to wait way too long for the constitutional right of marriage to materialize were a tangible reminder that change never happens as quickly as it should. This kind of change often seems impossible until it is inevitable. That night was not just a victory for and with America's same-sex couples. It was a victory for America. And my 8 years in the Obama White House only reaffirmed my belief that the movement to fight for equality should be every American's cause. I saw firsthand the impact of women's rights advocates who use their voices to fight for the LGBTQ community. The LGBTQ community who did the same for Black Lives Matter, and Black Lives Matter activists who spoke out for immigrants' rights. As Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. famously said, we are caught up in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. This defines our humanity and what we owe to one another. It should be our true north. Chapter 15. The Changing of the Guard. In the final weeks leading up to Election Day 2016, I began thinking about what I was going to do that night. During the last 2 presidential elections, we'd obviously planned large celebrations in Chicago. But now what? The president had mentioned to a few of us that he and the First Lady didn't intend to make any plans, but I had no intention of fretting by myself, so I more or less invited myself over. You know I can't sit home alone, I said to the president, so if it's okay with you and Michelle, I'll come over and spend the evening with you guys. He chuckled fine. In the meantime, we all did our best to keep focused on the business of running the White House. Earlier that year, a few staffers had left to work on the Clinton campaign, but those of us who remained knew the president expected us to run through the tape full speed ahead. To complete, as many of the items on his handwritten priority list as we could before leaving. Of course, we were all paying very close attention to the presidential race, but during our long work days, we were expected to focus. During Dennis's morning meetings, we never talked about the presidential campaign, ever. Even Election Day morning, Dennis reminded us we still have a transition ahead after tonight, regardless of the outcome. Those of us who stayed in the Obama administration until the end also did not meddle in the Clinton campaign. We could have called our campaign manager and said, "Tell us everything you're doing." We could have asked John Podesta, President Obama's former senior advisor, to brief us regularly. But it was Clinton's campaign, not ours. We had run President Obama's two campaigns just the way he wanted it, and we remembered what it was like to have people from the outside causing us angst by telling us what they thought we should do, so we intentionally did not butt into hers. The night before the election, I traveled with the Obamas to Philadelphia for Hillary Clinton's last rally. Our two teams, once rivals, shared hugs and excitement backstage, each in our own way absorbing what we thought would be an historic moment. The outcome seemed so inevitable. I'd never really allowed the thought that she could lose to penetrate my consciousness. In retrospect, there were signs. I did wonder how strange the anticipation must be for the president. On the sidelines, prepared to leave office, but very, very invested in the outcome. As usual, whatever he was feeling, the even-keeled president betrayed nothing but confidence and hope. The evening of November 8, after finishing up for the day, I popped upstairs to the residence, and the three of us ate dinner at their large round dining room table. I have no idea what we discussed, but it felt right to be together that night, after having our lives so deeply intertwined since years before Barack started his political journey 20 years earlier. After dinner, to kill time, the president suggested, "How about a movie?" The movie theaters in the White House and at Camp David both have large, very comfortable chairs upholstered in a soft fabric, each with a blanket, a pillow, and in the front row, a footrest. Camp David's even recline. It's well known among my friends and family that for the 8 years we were in the White House, perpetually exhausted from lack of sleep, the second the lights went down and my popcorn was finished, I would immediately pass out. Thinking any movie would put me to sleep and ease my anxiety, I said it sounded like a great idea to me that night. President Obama and I have very different tastes in movies. I enjoy romantic comedies such as Love Actually or classics such as The Philadelphia Story. The president's idea of a good movie is one with a complicated plot that involves a great deal of suffering and that ends with everybody dying. That night he selected the new Marvel superhero movie, Doctor Strange, and Michelle and I went along with his choice. So while voters continued to go to the polls to decide between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, we were distracted by a cartoonish action movie, hoping that when it ended, the waiting would be over and we could look forward to a Clinton presidency. But as the lights came up in the theater, President Obama pulled out his phone and said, By now, the polls had closed in all the time zones except the Pacific, and soon the exit poll data started to come in. We went back up to the residence and sat in their living room long enough to hear about a few more returns that made the outlook not nearly as good for Clinton as we had expected. It was at that point that the First Lady stood up and said, "Good night." "Where are you going?" I asked, trying still to absorb the news reports. She looked at me as if to say, "To bed, where people usually go after they say good night." "Are you really going to sleep?" I asked. "Yep." And that was it. Off she went. I didn't know what to do. Should I sit there and keep the president company, or did he want to be alone? The White House political director, David Simas, had been sending the president status emails, so soon after Michelle went to bed, I stood up and said I was going down to David's office. The president didn't object, so I took that as a sign that he'd rather be alone. In David's office, I found a few staffers, including my chief of staff, Johannes Abraham, looking extremely worried. Johannes had gone from field director in Iowa in the 2008 campaign to deputy national political director in 2012. He'd kept his ear to the ground during the campaign. He'd even returned to Iowa the previous week and become concerned when he visited a few of the neighborhoods that had supported Obama and were now supporting Trump. "She can still do this," David said, the eternal optimist. "There are still enough votes." Even in our lowest moments in the White House, David always entered any room with a big smile and a warm greeting. But as time went by and he continued to report the results, he began to run low on contingency plans that would make the end result okay. By midnight, his face turned grave. All expressions of hope had faded. I stayed for another couple of hours as the situation only became worse and worse, until the outcome seemed both inevitable and impossible to absorb. I then followed Mrs. Obama's example by going home and trying to sleep. Laura, who was living with me at the time, came home from her job at CNN around 3 a.m., and I woke up and asked her if the outcome had changed. She said, "Nope, Trump is the next president." The next morning, when reality hit again, I couldn't fathom how our country, which had elected Barack Obama twice, could have possibly elected Donald Trump. The election outcome was soul-crushing. Although most of us had been up late, everyone showed up on time, though we were all clearly shattered. But right after the senior staff meeting, I knew my team, many of whom had been a part of the family for a decade, and all too young to have enough experience to put this nightmare in context, needed to hear from me. I gathered them to try to buck them up. Their distraught look of shock and pain, and yes, tears, said it all, but they hoped I could help them understand what had happened. I told them that democracies always have setbacks and twists and turns, and that it was important to be resilient in the face of this defeat. I could tell by their expressions that they were hungry for words of wisdom. I just tried to mask my own emotions and reassure them that I was proud of what they had all done. During our meeting, we received word that President Obama intended to give remarks in the Rose Garden, so we abruptly adjourned. When my colleagues and I walked out on the colonnade, I knew the press would have cameras out to capture our reactions, so I put my game face on. Or so I thought. The photo of several of us clustered together as President Obama addressed the public showed unmistakable evidence of our soul-crushing pain. President Obama tried to reassure the country by publicly committing to a smooth and successful transition, just as Bush had done for us, because the peaceful transition of power is one of the hallmarks of our democracy. He went on to emphasize that we are all Americans and patriots first, and that our country needs a sense of unity, a sense of inclusion, a respect for our institutions, our way of life, rule of law, and respect for each other. And he said that he hoped Trump maintains that spirit. And he, too, congratulated his team for all they had done, without fanfare or a lot of attention, to make our government function better for all. And as though reading the thoughts of my team, he said, "But to the young people who got into politics for the first time and may be disappointed by the results, I want you to know you have to stay encouraged. Don't get cynical. Don't ever think you can't make a difference." President Obama concluded his remarks, and then it was back to work, continuing the job of running the government as well as preparing for its transition to another leader. I'd been dreading January 20, 2017, since January 20, 2009, and I woke up that morning thinking back on a conversation the president and I shared on a balmy night the previous September. The Obamas had invited me over for dinner, and afterwards Michelle left for a commitment with her mother and Sasha. The president and I had decided to share an after-dinner drink and unwind in our favorite spot, the Truman Balcony. Staring out at the majestic view, I started to wax nostalgic about the last 8 years and how extraordinary the experience had been, even on the hardest days, of which there were many. The first 4 years had been so challenging, bringing together this team of people, none of whom had worked together in the White House. Before long, we were all navigating new roles, trying to keep the world economy from collapsing, transforming our health insurance system, and grappling with two wars. It seemed like every single day we were choosing between bad and worse options. Although it was messy, when we had control of Congress, we had accomplished so much. By the second term, many of us had worked together all 4 years. We knew our strengths and weaknesses and trusted one another completely. Not that every day didn't have its challenges, for it certainly did, but the White House was running smoothly. We understood that Congress was dysfunctional, most recently by the Republicans' refusal to grant Judge Merrick Garland, President Obama's nominee to the Supreme Court, even a hearing. And so we had moved beyond them, utilizing executive orders, the bully pulpit, and partnerships with state and local government, civil society, and the business community to make progress where we could. The pinnacle for me in our final year was the United State of Women Summit in June. We wanted to protect the progress we'd made through the White House Council on Women and Girls by extending the ownership to those on the ground who'd carry on the work and scale it upward. At the summit, we showcased leaders of all backgrounds who were successfully tackling issues from economic empowerment and entrepreneurship, equal pay and paid leave, women's education and healthcare, violence against women, and civic engagement. Our over 200 speakers ranged from Billie Jean King and Warren Buffett to Ayanna Pressley and Brittany Packnett. We chose Marley Diaz, the 11-year-old founder of the campaign #1000BlackGirlsBook, to also speak. While in sixth grade, Marley launched an effort to put the spotlight on the paucity of books with black girls as the main characters. Her goal was to collect 1,000 books to donate to black girls. Within just a few months, she had collected 9,000. Poised and extraordinarily confident, she blew the audience away with her compelling remarks. She sold the message that, at a young age, it's hard to be what we cannot see. I, too, had made progress. Not only was all of my youthful shyness replaced by a voice I trusted that was full of passion and conviction, but after the privilege of 8 years of using it to push for equality and justice on a national scale, I was returning to the vital office of citizen. I had learned to take criticism and absorb any pain in stride. I was now convinced that extraordinarily positive change happens where there is hope, hard work, perseverance, and luck. All of this has helped me have the patience and strength to never give up. Now, 3 months from the end, just as we were humming, I didn't want to let it go. As the president's assistant, Farial Govashari, observed to me, anywhere else when you leave a job, you can go back and visit. When we leave this one, it disappears. I'm old enough to appreciate the brevity of 8 years and the finite opportunities it offered us. Yet, there were so many times in the last year when I desperately wished we could have extended his term. With the monuments twinkling in front of us, and as I moved on to my second martini, I wasn't keeping track of his, I started pushing the president to indulge my fantasy of a third term. "I'm so going to miss this place," I said. "Don't you wish we could just stay for 4 more years? Just imagine how much more we could get done." I had become a bit wistful, so he moved to the seat on the couch next to me, and with one arm draped over my shoulder, said gently, "Valerie, we cut the unemployment rate in half. 20 million people have health care, many for the first time. Any couple can marry. There are 2 additional extraordinary women serving on the Supreme Court. We brought Osama bin Laden to justice and 150,000 troops home from 2 wars. We have an agreement to keep Iran from developing nuclear weapons. There hasn't been a major terrorist attack on our shores. We restored diplomatic relations with Cuba. We led the effort for the historic Paris Climate Accord signed by 200 countries around the world. Our country is not perfect, but it is more just and fair for those who have historically been left behind. I'm alive, My family's alive. You're alive. Yes, there's more work to do, but there always is. We did our best. He then paused and lowered his voice even further, and he said, "It's time for us to go." As his words sank in,